I'm Pauline Helmsley-Vinson, Interim Director of the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. The CNGM podcast highlights the voices of contemporary Arab American writers. It is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the Arab American National Museum. And I have the pleasure today of interviewing and having a conversation with Heather Raffo. Heather is a singular and outstanding voice in the American theater whose work has been championed by The New Yorker as, quote, an example of how art can remake the world. Having helped forge a new genre of Arab American theater, she spent her career writing and embodying stories of Iraq, from the lives and dreams of Iraqi women in her seminal work, Nine Parts of Desire, 2003, to the suicidal ideation of an Iraq war veteran in the opera Fallujah, 2012, to the restless longings of an Iraqi refugee architect in Noura, 2018. A multi-award-winning writer and actor, she's toured nationally and internationally, from the Kennedy Center to the Aspen Ideas Festival, and from London's House of Commons to the U.S. Islamic World Forum. Her newly released anthology, Heather Raffo's Iraq Plays, The Things That Can't Be Said, brings together two decades of her most groundbreaking contributions to the American theater and speaks to the bravery required to be at the forefront of a movement. Her newest, Migration Play Cycle, her most ambitious theatrical imagining in scale and scope, situates themes around migration and the global economy. Being raised in the Midwest and the daughter of an Iraqi immigrant, Raffo has committed her artistic practice to working across all kinds of borders, on main stages and in rural communities, with the military and in the Arab world, in swing states and in refugee facilities. She is uniquely positioned to explore what migration means for an ever-evolving American and global identity. Heather, we are honored to have you on CNGM. Thank you for being with us.
It's an absolute honor to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So I'd like to start the discussion today with you with publication of this new collection, your new book. The title really intrigued me, having made myself familiar with all your work and followed you throughout different years of your productions, and most recently having had the privilege of seeing you act in at the Detroit Public Theater. The things that can't be said, that really captures a theme that I see throughout your work so beautifully. And yet those of us who have had the privilege of seeing Noura and or read the play, a lot of Noura's character is about the need for disclosure. Can you talk about this tension between the things that can't be said and the need to disclose?
Yes, and it's always surprising because when you go to see the theater, what you're really seeing is people talking. So you're wondering, what is it they're not saying? Is something that you can get away with in a novel or even a film with long silences you don't often get away with in the theater. So Noura is on stage for the whole show. She's on stage for 90 minutes, and yet it's really only in the end that her secret comes out. So you see a brave woman, a vocal woman, a woman with agency in her own life, but ultimately you realize she's been harboring deep, deep silences that have really weighed upon her soul, weighed upon her culture, and have upended her family. And so I think that that is the tension that I'm exploring in a lot of my work, where the characters in my plays tend to be absolutely passionate about their agency and what they've come to tell, right? But then at some point in their process, they're also exploring the taboos.
Right.
And in exploring those taboos, they do so lovingly. So it's not, let's say, an airing of dirty laundry or just taboo for taboo's sake. It's right. That they are absolutely exploring how secrets and silences have rearranged their heart and rearranged their life and what it might be like to speak past that. And I think I've only now in my 50s, when I like see my work kind of put together in an anthology like that, I realize that I was sitting on my own silences as a artist, as a woman, as a person. And I realized that so much of my subconscious was that it would be dangerous to express myself. And so in pursuing a career in acting and only after being fully in it, turning to writing, my kind of forced bravery was because I essentially had a belief system that it would be dangerous to express myself. And yet I knew I had to.
That's really beautiful. There is a line in Noura that resonated with me, stayed with me. At one point, Noura, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, she says, silence is survival. Or you say it in your introduction, I think, but also what you just said so beautifully, how silences have rearranged one's heart. That's really captures that so amazingly. And the tension between those two, that we do need to be silent for survival sometimes. It is essential, and yet it does something to you. And your plays, each one of the Iraq plays really captures that so beautifully. And as you said, so lovingly, because it's easy to disclose, right? Mm-hmm. It's difficult to disclose lovingly and kindly, and yet also critically. Mm-hmm. And that combination of things. Another related theme that I see in your plays is goes along with disclosure and silence is the narratives you tell are not the conventional narratives, mm-hmm. right? They purposely are not the conventional narratives. It's not the refugee story, right? It's not the Iraqi woman. It's not the Iraq war story. Can you talk about that in each of the plays and how you approach that and how you work with that, with the conventional narrative and then your contribution to it?
Yeah, I think that having been steeped in classical theater as an upbringing, my MFA work was almost entirely in Shakespeare and classical work. And that's what I thought I wanted to do, is to be a classical theater actress. And I knew that it was a great groundwork for any acting. But I can see now that I had a large body of classics to pull from in my understanding of story and theme. But I also felt that, I mean, when I started writing, there was not a genre of Arab American theater or Middle Eastern American theater. So to even attempt something felt like we were breaking the mold, all of us artists that were beginning in the late 90s, early aughts. But most essentially, I knew that we would be countering stereotypes left and right. And to begin with Nine Parts of Desire in the late 90s, the stereotype of an Iraqi woman would be silenced, veiled in abaya, or a victim, right? And sadly, here we are over 20 years later. And I would say for Western American culture, that might still be a stereotype. So to approach a play like Nine Parts of Desire with not a single character being a victim, having them feel comfortable in speaking through their traumas, but always in pursuit of life and love and their intellectual rigor, was really incredible for American audiences during the war.
Right.
And we have to remember that, you know, we're looking at that play now 20 years later. When it came out, it was during an active war where we couldn't, as people in the West, American citizens, American journalists, couldn't get information on the ground about what Iraqis were really thinking and feeling. So people came to that play with, thankfully, a really open heart and really wanted to hear the other side of the war. And I think that that play absolutely discombobulated audiences and opened them to the deep humanity and centuries of culture that Iraq and Iraqis embody, and gave them a window into a radical femininity that they couldn't have imagined having access to. And I think Noura picks up on that by absolutely working with it's a pushback to Ibsen's A Doll's House.
Yes.
And it's a pushback to Doll's House because we continue, even in this day and age, we continue to pull out that play as if it's a feminist drama, as if it might be the feminist drama. And mm-hmm. it's so frustrating to me that that is the representation still of what feminist drama is. And when I look at that play, I think, okay, at the time when it came out, they burned the theater down.
Yeah.
That's how radical it was for a woman to speak her truth and then leave her husband and kids.
Yes.
So they burned the theater down. When we do it today, there isn't an ounce of that
right.
happening in the audience. All we see is a husband figure that we don't like from the beginning, even if they play the relationship for love, right?
Right.
And we're cheering for her to speak her mind and walk out. There's absolutely no cultural tension
right.
to understand that play in context. So I wanted to create something where the marriage might be, there might be tensions in the marriage, but it's one full of love, and where this mother is deeply attached to her kids, because in a doll's house, the kids are props. And you're like, well, if you've got props, it's going to be easy to walk out.
Right.
What is that story about? Like, what would happen if she was absolutely besotted with her children, but needed to take action? Right. So I think that, those are some of the ways that I've been working with, what I know are the expectations, but ultimately what I really feel I'm following is kind of the rhythm of my own heart. Nine Parts of Desire and Nora and Fallujah are very circular plays.
Yes.
They're not linear. They're not three-act plays. They're not following conventions. They are absolutely moving to my sense of my own time signature and my feminine rhythms. We really feel like we're revolving in them. They feel very circular. I think oftentimes they're open-ended. I leave something hanging that almost feels like you could pick it up in the next play,
yes,
right?
Yes, and that was my experience watching Nora. It's like, there are certain things that I was like expecting to happen that didn't quite. And I was like, I want to see, like, you know, in my mind had the fullness of completion. Mm-hmm. And yet there were these elements that left you thinking, oh, so what would be the reaction to mm-hmm. this, or, you know, in a very interesting and beautiful way. Mm-hmm. And that gave the characters complexity and depth and continuity. And this isn't, the end and the finality of, let's say, walking out.
Yeah, I'm not tying up theme or plot.
Yeah.
I'm leaving us hanging in the middle of somebody's heart.
Yeah.
It's with all the beautiful characters. You don't know what is the physical action of the last beat of the play, or even the last 30 minutes.
Yeah.
All you know is you're hanging on her heart,
yeah,
and her husband's heart and her kid's heart, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Everybody just gets cracked open and then left there for us to observe it.
Yes. Yes. And in that sense, if I may, just from my own personal response, your plays are so contemporary aesthetically, and yet they bring, as you said, that Shakespearean or operatic fullness, if you will, that classical sort of expansive feeling, mm-hmm. sense of expansive feeling, right? It's all there, like larger than life. And yet it is about these very contemporary issues and very singular lives, and in a very contemporary aesthetic, as you said, you know, the refusal to give complete closure, right? And very woman-centered, for sure. That came through so, of course, in Nine Parts of Desire, where the nine parts are nine different women presenting their thoughts and feelings to the audience directly, sort of like nine one-woman shows in one play, which is incredible, especially considering that you acted all parts. So that's something I want to come back to, hopefully. But also in Nora, the maternal impulse is so strong and so powerful in that play. It's not the dominating thing. You know, this woman is very multifaceted. She's an architect. She's left her country. She's conflicted about certain relationships. She has depth, and all of these things are there in her so beautifully. So yeah, it's an experience to watch.
Yeah, I agree. I do think they're, all my work is, I feel like they're very feminine plays, but even Fallujah, which is hugely about a male character and the group of Marines he's serving with. So it's a very male-centered play. And even Nora has three other male characters that are absolutely central to Nora's life. I guess the way I look at it is holding masculinity from a feminine lens is very interesting to me as a writer.
Beautiful.
And to attempt to deeply write masculinity, but write it from my own heart and point of view in the way that I would write about my son, or the way I would write about my husband or my father, which I think the way women hold the men they love so deeply and dearly, they are able to expose certain vulnerabilities that I haven't quite seen in lots of literature. I've really enjoyed writing the layers of masculinity that I've had access to thus far.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, that's very nice. And along with this sort of holding masculinity from a feminine point of view, there is this holding of Iraq and the U.S. And can you talk about how you hold both in all three plays?
That's a beautiful question. I think I hold Iraq with a lot of admiration. I hold it with a deep sense of reverence. For me, it's an ancient culture. When I think of my Iraqiness, it feels like I'm touching something thousands of years old, even though why should I feel that way as a woman moving through the world in this time frame? But I do. I think also my reverence comes from having met so much of my Iraqi family in the few visits I had to Iraq, where, 100 family members would gather and eat and celebrate and be together in community. And that was something I really craved growing up in the States and didn't have. So that reverence toward community and bonds and history and ancientness is very palpable for me. And I would say the way I hold my Americanness is with a great sense of hope. That has to be true, because if I didn't have hope, I wouldn't have written these three plays. They're written in English. They're for an American audience. And if I'm putting my body and my thoughts and my fear of expressing myself suddenly on stage or in a community, I feel like I'm going up against all odds to be the physical bridge between an Iraqi culture and an American culture. Like, I do think in some ways those cultures are incommensurable, but they have so much to learn from each other. So because I can lovingly hold both, I feel like I'm kind of doing what my parents did. I'm standing in between. Yeah. Like I'm the birth child, right? Of these two halves. It's a hope for an American audience that they will have an open heart. I'm not attacking an American audience. I'm saying, look, don't you respond to these people? Don't you feel like you could be these people? Like,
yeah.
Be a part of this community with us. Welcome into our community. So many of the monologues in Nine Parts are welcoming. It's like you're already at the table. It's like you're already a week in, dinners, tea, hours into the conversation, and now this woman's going to tell you her secret, right?
Yes.
So to treat an entire American audience as if they got to the table, they're the beloved one that got in, is how I'm holding them, with that great hope that if they were only on the inside, they would get it.
That's beautiful. And that's so true to my recent experience with Noura. I mean, there's literally a table there that you're bringing the audience to. The setting is a Chaldean Christmas Eve, and it's very specific. Mm-hmm. I find a lot of Arab American work struggles with how to translate to an audience that may not be familiar with certain references or practices. And yet you don't translate, you invite. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And that invitation is so open and beautiful. Can you talk about that? Whether in Nine Parts, but also specifically at the Christmas Eve dinner.
Yeah, the way you said it is really beautiful, to invite and not to translate. I do think, because I appreciate modern work that doesn't translate, that just doesn't take that extra 20 minutes from our lives to make sure that every I is dotted and every T is crossed and everybody understands everything. I think what I try to do is work from a place of the heart, where if somebody is invited in, they will understand that they're at the table. They will understand that they're welcome. Yeah. They will understand if they arrive without stereotype and just open themselves up to these people, there's really nothing not to understand. Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah. And along with that, there's a specificity to your work and all of your plays. It's very specific to a place, people, tensions,
culture,
all of these things. And yet it's all these non-localized feelings of the heart. And that really comes through love, loss, right? That feeling of loss comes through very clearly in your plays and how people struggle with that loss. That comes through very movingly without being, you talk about how you don't want empathy, right? You want understanding. And that comes through so beautifully in your plays. Can you talk about how you manage that to avoid the sort of sympathy, oh, I feel sad for them, too bad, but I'm so lucky in my life kind of response, to that connecting over the moving part, that connection that you produce so powerfully in your plays, and that I personally experienced, watching your play too. So do you want to talk about your process for that? Because that's not an easy...
Yeah, no, I think I'm still in process on everything, but I'm particularly in process on that. So I do think when I started writing Nine Parts of Desire, which I started in 1998 and then pursued more fully in 2000, And then its off-Broadway premiere was in 2004. In that time, I was still thinking empathy was the goal. Right? If I can only get an American audience to see Iraqis as human beings, but also challenge them with the depth and agency of these Iraqi women, they will .. Mm-hmm. They will understand Iraqis as a beautiful culture. They will disagree with the war. When I first wrote Nine Parts of Desire, I was still in a belief system that empathy was the goal. Mm-hmm. That getting an American audience to understand and see themselves in the shoes of Iraqis could change their perception of the war. And it worked. Those that saw it would say things to me like, I'd never saw Iraqis as human beings, or I'd had no idea that these things were going on, or they felt their hearts had been rearranged, right? Noura also is a play that can really open up audiences. Here in Detroit, we're doing talkbacks, and the Chaldeans will really express themselves saying, this, you voice something that we've been carrying. Arab Americans will say the same, but then we have a lot of audience, black and white and liberal and conservative, saying how deeply they feel with the characters. That it's a woman last night was talking about how she said every marriage has secrets. And in watching this, she just felt really undone about the thing she's been carrying. Other people have expressed to us that they were adopted and that this sense of there's an orphan in the play and the pursuit of motherhood and these idea system. People are identifying with lots of things. That's empathy. It does work. It is a value in the American theater. But the thing I'm chewing on recently in the past 4 or 5 years is that it's just not good enough. It's been the goal of the American theater to create empathy across communities, across peoples. And I do think it's great to come to the theater and put yourself in somebody else's shoes. But so often that's what we do. And we cry or we laugh or we have this empathetic experience. And then we go home and we really don't understand our own connection to it. That things we do in our life are actually impacting these people. So what Noura is not doing as a play, for instance, is you go and you watch it and you really feel for that family. But as audience, do you ever consider the fact that you put gasoline in your car on the way to the theater was likely the reason that Noura had to leave home?
Yeah.
Nobody's making that connection. They're coming and watching this play and feeling the things they feel and saying, gosh, I wish her life could have been easier, or having all this empathy. But are we ever, as audience, myself included, ever making that real connection between what we do in our day-to-day lives and the impact it has on people across the world or across town or across the street?
Or how it reverberates back to us, right?
Right. So the thing I'm holding with my new work is just that. How do I allow empathy to be one thing the theater does, but not the goal? That the goal is some other level of connection between audience and subject matter, or between audiences in Detroit and audiences in Iraq. Like, wouldn't that be amazing if audiences could connect, not just with the play, but with each other? If Noura was being done in Mosul, and Detroit and Maslawi audiences could have a way to say, wow, you experienced it like that. I'm experiencing this. That, I mean, because Noura has been done in DC, in New York, in Abu Dhabi, in Marin, in San Diego, in Cairo. I am the only one carrying all those audiences in my mind and going, this felt this and they felt that way. And wouldn't it be cool if we could, they would learn so much if they could talk to each other. But I'm the only one that carries that. So what I'm trying to do now is create a theatrical platform where those idea systems can exist, where audiences can cross-pollinate with a similar work that is taking place in different parts of the world.
Amazing. That's such an incredible project. Can't wait to see what you do with that.
Me too. Yeah. It's very exploratory, experimental.
Is this the same connected or side by side?
This is the migration play cycle.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that one?
Yeah. I'm researching migration and following the global economy. I'm researching it in cities and locales across the globe. And wherever I go or get to do a residency or even just find myself traveling, I'll research and write a scene that takes place in that community. And the goal would be to have like 300 scenes from across the world, of which on any given night at the theater, you would see maybe 15, right? So if Detroit were to present this play, you'd go for a 90-minute play, you'd see 15 of these scenes, but Detroit would somehow be the fulcrum through which all those other scenes written around the world would fall, so that Detroiters would see their concerns represented, but then see how their concerns are impacting people across the globe. Mm-hmm. And then the hope would be that there is an immersive web platform where audiences can go, maybe during the show, maybe after show, somehow, to experience all these other scenes that take place across the world. And that it would be ever evolving, ever growing. It can expand and contract. It can just move like the globe does. And I think in that way, it's very much like migration itself. It's not static. We don't go see a play about migration and go, okay, well, that was the story. It's just not the story. There's always another part. There's always another impact. There's always something else going on. It definitely lets us do these deep dives into people's lives and into situations. But what's linking it together is not character or plot or following the heart of one individual. It's economics. So the reason you move from one place to the next, or the reason you're catapulted from that water bottle to some other story about water, is purely economics. We are connected by nature. We are connected by water and the globe itself, but we are most deeply impacting each other through economics.
Yeah.
What we buy, what we need, what we use, our resources.
That's so powerful. What an incredible undertaking and exciting. Really can't wait to see how you develop that. Along those lines of the impact and the courage it takes to express those ideas. And so for me, watching live theater, I always feel there's a lot of courage in the individual actors, right? Going on stage. It's such an intimate space most of the time. Sometimes it's large theaters where there's a bit of a distance, but a lot of your plays are experienced in intimate theater settings with the audience. You act in most of them, but you also share the scenes with other actors. And I think it takes bravery to do all of those dimensions. So can you talk about your role as a playwright, the bravery it takes to do that, and then to act, and then also to let go of the acting. What is that like for you?
Yeah, I would say that in the writing, it feels like I'm always excavating sort of the deepest parts of my own soul. While I do a lot of research with real life people and in communities, in order to capture what feels like the heart of the tension that other people are holding, I always let that be translated in my personal life with what I'm holding too. So my writing does feel very exposing. As much as it's about others and communities, I have to bring myself to it. So it's vulnerable. Mm-hmm. But I would say that the acting in my own work is more vulnerable, because I have to physically put my body into those positions and into those characters' lives. So many of them are dealing with quite epic things. And I also realize that as an actor, your body really, really is taking on the audience's energy every night, whether they're agreeing or disagreeing or understanding or fighting it, right? It's a really intense place to physically put oneself every night. And of course, the characters I write aren't ever easy breezy,
right?
Like, they're all going through high stakes. And I think that it's only this year that I kind of made peace. I was carrying this piece of my childhood, like a subconscious piece of my childhood that was unspoken. My father never wanted me to be an actor or go into the theater. My mom didn't understand it either. Like, why would I want to go on stage? Why would I want to do that? I keep thinking I never loved being up in front of people. So it wasn't a need to be seen.
Right.
It's like, but why am I pursuing this craft? And I realized this little seed I've been carrying about it being dangerous to express myself was because so often in my childhood, I was kind of told not to express myself. Mm. Right. And I was discouraged from expressing myself. I became a real fighter because of that. I became very mouthy in my teenage years. Right. Gotten lots of fights with my dad. And at first I thought, you know, he's keeping me down. Why does he want to keep me down? What is he? Right. I became a feminist because he was keeping me down. And then I realized really so long after the fact that from his personal cultural perspective, he wanted to keep me alive.
Mm.
It was that simple. Mm. His subconscious heart and mind was that if I said brave things publicly in front of people and acted them out, I could be killed. And that's just a fact. That's not even maybe a subconscious thing. That's a absolutely valid, real thing. When they did Nine Parts of Desire in Sulaymaniyah at the university there, they had to cut over half the play. Yeah. They still had an amazing experience, but like you couldn't say that on stage in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And even we could get into what it means to be an actor in the Middle East. Like that's not always welcome in families and communities. But how did I have to get to be over 50 years old before I finally processed that every time I go on stage, my DNA is telling me you will die if you do this. You shouldn't do this. It's not safe to do this. And how we make peace with those subconscious molecules in ourselves,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. You can really see how Noura got to be the play it is, if yeah. that's the subconscious terrain that is moving in Heather, right? Even though I'm in the United States, I'm safe, you can be an actor here, it's no big deal, right? Like all those things, the mechanism in my DNA is that you need to kind of, that stepping out and doing this is against all odds. So I think I still experience that performing. What's been really healing, and I have to say this because we're at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, I have not performed in Michigan in over 2 decades. I went to University of Michigan, but I haven't come back as a professional. And oftentimes performing for your own community, like performing for your own family, is the most difficult thing, right? It's so much easier to go across the world, do your thing, say your thing, and not worry about it. And the way the Arab American Museum has supported me and the way the Chaldean community has supported me and the Chaldean Cultural Center and the way audiences from both those communities are coming to the show and staying after, not to give myself or the other actors praise, they give us praise, it's beautiful, but to speak their own story.
Yeah.
Right? Is so validating. They're saying, we feel seen.
Mm.
We've never seen ourselves on stage in this way. And then they want to tell us their story. So I think that for me, that has healed that part about it being dangerous because they recognize that it's dangerous and they're validating myself and the other actors for doing this historical first time thing.
Yes.
For this community.
Yes.
That's just beautiful. It's beautiful to go out every night in front of people who know these stories, have lived them and have them want it. Mm-hmm. Or say, yes, that was brave to do it. Thank you for doing it. Now I feel like I'm looking at my own culture differently. And then to further answer your question, it is a beautiful process to let go of your own work and let other actors do it.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Sometimes it's difficult when you want things to be different. But when people are bringing their entire souls and histories to something and bringing textures that you could never have imagined, the way designers do, the way directors do, right? It's an incredible process. I couldn't ask for more from the actors that are here.
Oh, terrific.
Matiko David, Khaled Abunaga, Amanda Nager, Mugi Fawaz, like they are each so exquisite and bringing such textured detail to their roles.
Yeah.
And Mike Masalam, his direction, the designers, like it's really been an incredible, incredible process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can attest to the beauty and power of it all, having had the privilege to attend that play with this cast, with this director, and with you carrying, your character is always there. It must be exhausted at the end.
It's true. I'm tired.
But it's a good exhaustion, right? It's that completion. And I want to just follow up with something that you said, about the connecting with it. And I do agree. I mean, you talk about a very specific Iraqi experience, but this experience of war and loss is unfortunately shared by so many, right? So many from the Arab community, Lebanese, Syrian, Yemeni, and so on, but also by so many in the world who are experiencing violence of some sort that necessitates leaving, and the loss and the choices and the tensions that you bring out that can be connected to on so many different levels. And I have to agree with you about the support here, the Arab American Museum and the Center of Arab American Studies, UM Dearborn, which I'm fortunate to be part of for this year, and be able to perform in a theater, a local theater. All of these things come together so nicely and so beautifully. And I feel that your work, the way, as you mentioned, there wasn't much Arab American theater when you started writing and producing these plays. There is fortunately now, right?
It's beautifully. Yes. Now it's a full movement. Now there are new generations of writers. There's old, middle, and new generations of writers. It's absolutely compelling.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. No, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And 20 years. That's all it took. 20 years.
It's incredible.
And God knows where it's going.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just beginning.
And the way these different communities support each other, right? I'm an academic, but your work supports mine, and I hope my work supports yours in different ways, intersections and things like that, that are really so nice to see. And one of the things that I am getting out of the way you're talking about this process of producing your work and vulnerability is how generous you are, how generous it is to be, in your place and to open up certain things that are vulnerable to audiences when you don't know, you're putting yourself there, your body, as you said, as an actress. Thank you for this. Thank you for your work. I can't wait to see your next project. Thank you for this interview. It's been a pleasure, Heather.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's episode was hosted by Pauline Homsi-Vinson. It was produced by Muhammad Jafar and Esma Baban and edited by Muhammad Jafar. Our theme song was composed by Isra Darwish, and our logo was created by Maisara Abdelhaq. Scene Jim is brought to you by the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn and the Arab American National Museum. Scene Jim is funded by the University of Michigan Arts Initiative and the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan Dearborn. Check out our website, scenejimpodcast.org, for more information on our guests and to view videos of their readings. Thank you for listening.